I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE as the largest country on earth, target of a brutal proxy war through Ukraine, heads to the polls to elect a president amidst near-totalitarian anti-Russian propaganda in Western Europe, where coverage of Nazis in Ukraine is banned. It is Vladimir Putin who is expected to have had a good war and win a fifth presidential term in the Kremlin. Today, a decade to the day that the people of Crimea overwhelmingly voted to rejoin Russia, I'm joined from Moscow by the former director of the now-defunct Carnegie Moscow Center. That was the Russian arm of the controversial Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also a retired colonel in the Soviet and Russian armed forces, and he's now a member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council, Dr. Dmitry Trenin. Thank you so much, Dr. Trenin, for coming on. Today's also the anniversary of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, but I don't think NATO nation propaganda media are going to be talking about 6 million dead in Indochina. It'll actually be claiming, on this second day of voting there in Russia, it'll be claiming Putin is a dictator. And is that the question, or is the question, why is he so popular on this second day of voting?
Well, I think he is genuinely someone who is popular. I don't think is the right word under the circumstances. I think that for the vast majority of Russians, he is the right man at the right time in the right job. And they want him to stay in that job. And call it support, call it popularity, but that's the reality. And I think that the final result of the vote will show that his popularity is at its highest or one of the highest levels since he assumed power a quarter century ago.
But why do the Russian people feel that way, given that some might think he was the wrong man at the wrong time? His delay in acting to stop the NATO nation proxy war through Ukraine to save the people of Donbass. Of course, now the US press is revealing the CIA bases on Russia's borders. It was only the Communist Party and the Duma that forced his hand. He's the wrong person, isn't he? He belatedly came in to defend those people being massacred by NATO nation weaponry.
Well, if we're talking about the conflict in Ukraine that started back in 2014, I think at that time, President Putin took a view that the issue could be solved by a combination of a Russian action in Crimea and Crimea's reunification with the Russian Federation. And at the same time, a diplomatic, a political solution with regard to Donbass, the two regions of Donbass, Donetsk and Lugansk, that Moscow did not recognize as sovereign states or sovereign entities apart from Ukraine until on the eve of the military action, the special military operation that Putin ordered on the 24th of February, 2022. In his later interviews, he regretted, or at least he talked about the option of using fully the mandate that he was given in 2014 by the Russian Federation Council, the upper chamber, which gave him the right to use Russian military forces in Ukraine, not just in Crimea, which at that time belonged to Ukraine, but in the country in general. At the time when the legitimate president was toppled by a Western-supported mob in a coup, and Russia still did not recognize the new authorities in Kiev. So Putin essentially gave diplomacy a chance, and that chance was never taken by the opposite side.
Yeah, and so he trusted the Minsk process whilst people were being killed in eastern Ukraine. I know he wasn't the boss, as it were, when Libya, Africa's richest per capita country, was destroyed. It was Medvedev when Russia abstained at the Security Council. But there seems to be a lot going on with these Russian leaders in trusting European players. I know, obviously, Angela Merkel has subsequently said the Minsk process was just a delaying tactic to increase arms supplies to Kiev. Do you think Putin has learned a lot in the past 5 years?
I think we all learned a lot in the past 5 years, or the last 30 years, if you take a longer view. I think that Russians today are, in general, very different, also in their attitudes to foreign affairs than they were in the 90s or in the early 2000s. I think they certainly would not trust other people's words. They would look at their own capabilities of protecting their own interests. That would come first. And any guarantees that foreigners could theoretically give could only be worth anything if the Russian positions were sufficiently backed up by Russia's own forces.
I should say the far right contesting the elections and the left would never say they were naive about these threats. What is the source of this naivety that you talk about amongst Putin and other people? I don't know what you were saying, actually, after the 2014 coup, infamously, the Victoria Nuland phone call explaining how they did it. Were you also trusting these Western leaders? Because I tell you, the Global South, now on Russia's side, they never trusted these former colonial master countries.
I think that they were, call it naivety. I think that Putin himself talked about naivety when he was asked that question a while ago. I think we all believed that
why?
At the end of the Cold War. Well, why? I think there's something about Russian attitudes to the outside world, including the Western world, that is that tends to look for good outcomes, good relations. Russians are people with long memories, but those long memories do not hinder them forgetting, well, not forgetting, but forgiving.
I mean, you were in the secret services. Was that your attitude too? Surely you knew there was subterfuge, and every other country from Latin America through Africa through Southeast Asia and the Far East is being manipulated in some way by all sorts of soft power entities and the IMF and the World Bank. And yet there was this level of trust amongst the post-Soviet elites in the past 10 years, you say?
I think that it's not just the elites. I think it's a broader phenomenon. Just think of it. 28 million Soviet citizens died as a result of the German invasion of the Soviet Union back in 1941. And yet Russians until today actually bear very little grudge or no grudge against the Germans of today, against the German people in general. There is nothing like what the Ukrainians are doing with regard to the Russian heritage in Ukraine that was happening in Russia, in the Soviet Union, in the wake of the Second World War. As long as the enemy was defeated, he was looked upon as in many ways, except for those who were brought to trial, as victims of Nazi propaganda, victims of the Nazi regime, and they were made friends, into friends and into partners. And in the early 2000s, you won't believe it today, but Germany was considered to be the friendliest nation as far as Russia was concerned, except maybe for Belarus. There's some inkling within the Russian mind to look at the brighter side of things, to look at the possibilities of friendship and partnership and stuff like that. It's I think it's part of belonging to a big nation which essentially feels basically secure, which doesn't engage in petty charges and all that you see in spades around Russia never actually happened within Russia, and I think that's a good thing. This predilection to see the better side of your neighbors, of even of the former enemies.
Well, clearly things were warm between Berlin and Moscow. And then, OK, if I'm accusing the entire Russia's elite system of being naive, I think it surprised everyone, their reaction to the American destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline that was so important for Germany's economy. Perhaps no one could have predicted that. But surely voters will be saying, look at those problems with the Wagner private mercenary outsourced group in the past couple of years. Look at the fact that actually, just relating to what you just said, the secret services in Russia had no idea that what was really going on in these European capitals was to double-cross Putin every step of the way on Ukraine, as it did on every other issue, seemingly.
Well, I would presume that that Russian intelligence was supplying the Kremlin leadership with adequate report, or with reports that adequately described the situation in those capitals and those countries.
For 8 years since the coup in Kyiv.
Yes. So I don't think that there were illusions, but there were hopes. There were hopes that a political solution was a possibility. I think those hopes lasted at least until 2019. I think it was in 2019 the failed attempt by Russia to reach out to the newly elected Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky, and engage him in a discussion about the political solution in Donbass that they eventually disabused themselves of those early illusions. From late 2019, I think, we've seen this escalation of tensions and the waning of hopes with regard to the solution to the Ukrainian crisis. But prior to that, for 5 years, there were hopes. I think that there was some sort of a hope that Russia's status as a nuclear superpower would protect it from being aggressed politically in such a sensitive area. There were always memories of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the way the United States reacted to the Soviet incursion in the Western Hemisphere. That people thought, well, that was a lesson we learned, and that was also the lesson that the United States might have learned. But that was, I think, people were wrong, including myself. I think I also believe that way.
Dr. Dmitry Trenin, I'll stop you there. More from a member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former director of the Carnegie Moscow Center and now member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council, Dr. Dmitry Trenin. We were just talking about 1962 in relation to these elections and how perhaps no one expected the brinkmanship from Washington, given the NATO powers acting against Russia through Ukraine have nuclear weapons. But on the election itself, you know how propaganda media in the Western countries will cover this election. They'll say that there are widespread irregularities. There were, according to Golos, which is quoted in the Moscow Times. You have newspapers in Russia that can oppose the government. Arguably, you don't have them in European Union countries, or certainly Britain, where I'm from. Is it a sign of weakness that NATO countries will be desperately reviving the name of Navalny, a man who's hated in the Muslim world, of course, for his support of extermination of Muslims? They'll be reviving his name and be talking about widespread violations at these so-called free elections in Russia.
Well, I don't think that people now, as opposed to a few years earlier, care at all about how the West sees Russia's election. The important thing is how the Russian people see these elections. And in my view, the Russian people overwhelmingly believe that the elections are what they should be, and that the result of the election actually reflects the popular will.
Is it your sense that there are demographic analyses to be done as to Russian voters, elderly, poorer voters perhaps supporting the Communist Party, more middle-class ones in the cities voting for the Liberal Party, the majority voting for Putin? Are these the dynamics involved at this election?
Well, I think there's always dynamics in any election, and demography is one of the very important ingredients in analyzing the results of any election. I think that in Russia, though, there's been a shift, a massive shift, toward what you would call patriotism. And this patriotism, the flag bearer of the patriotism, of course, is President Putin. But also, I would say that what stands out in this election campaign and against the background of the war that's going on, not very far from where I sit in Moscow, is the emphasis on the social programs in President Putin's electoral program and in the actions of the Russian government. So Putin is essentially focusing on social issues, even as Russia has to invest much more in the defense industry and in national defense in general. And I think that is something that the Russian public believes is right. So you need to have a strong military, and that strong military needs to protect your national interest. But you also need to avoid the mistake that the Soviet Union made, and actually Putin recently referred to that, of essentially putting too much investment into the military, thus literally arming itself to death. And Putin is holding the balance between the needs of national security on the one hand and the needs of social development on the other hand.
Well, clearly a lot of critics in the United States about the fact that they're avowedly favouring military Keynesianism as a way to recover the United States economy. But does Putin owe Joe Biden a bit? Biden on the 26th of March 2022 saying Putin cannot remain in power. Is it statements like that, explicit statements from the White House by Joe Biden that Putin can thank Biden for in terms of the reaction in Russia to statements like that?
Well, I would say this. The fundamental changes that are happening in Russia right now, there's a sea change happening in Russia from Russian Federation 1.0 to Russian Federation 2.0. These changes would never, in my view, be possible, at least in the short term, absent the absolutely virulent reaction by the West to the special military operation in Ukraine. So the decision to put Russia under the harshest sanctions regime witnessed in modern history, and absent the proxy war that the United States and its NATO allies are waging against Russia in Ukraine, many of those changes would take much longer, and maybe we would not see them for a very long time. So in a way, this pushed Russia, the aggression from the outside has pushed Russia off the point where it got stuck in the middle to late 2010s, And now Russia, I think, is developing much faster in so many realms than let's say, a decade ago or two decades ago.
When it was pursuing straight down the line neoliberal policies. On that class consciousness issue, is there a degree of forgiveness then because of the sanctions? Because it's clear there were anecdotal reports that I heard. Poorer Russians got drafted first and conscripted first to the front. There were teething problems, some would say inexcusable, as regards the leadership in the military as part of this operation. I mean, it was only this week that the head of the Navy, I understand, Nikolai M. Ivanov, has been relieved of his post, the commander. Do the Russian people forgive these problems as part of this special military operation? We don't hear that kind of problem, particularly on the NATO-backed proxy forces.
Well, I don't think you can talk about forgiveness, but I think the reality is that any war exposes failures, shortcomings, crimes committed in peacetime. And at the beginning of the war, you have to pay for them dearly. And I think Russia today is no exception.
But people were killed in Belgorod this week. People were killed in Russia
this
week.
The list is right. No. That's correct. But that is I don't think that again, forgiving is the right word. I think that people shall be judged, shall be brought to account, and are being brought to account for the things they did wrongly, for the failures that they were responsible for. Maybe you do not publicize that during wartime or actual wartime or de facto wartime, but clearly there are lots of shortcomings and problems and in the system. But you would also, I think, agree that in the 2 years of fighting, Russia has learned a lot, has gained a lot of experience. And that experience has, well, you know, it's also owing to somebody's excellent effort to ramp up, for example, production of military materiel. People on the other side were stunned by Russia being able to ramp up the production of its artillery shells, tanks, aircraft, and many other war machines. And also the Russian economy, as the Russian financial system, has been able to withstand the massive blow that, again, the people who engineered the sanctions regime thought that Russia would crumble, that the ruble will be turned to rubble. And, you know, we've heard all these things, and these things did not come true. Again, this is also thanks to somebody's effort. And there were expectations that the Russian public would be so shaken, aggrieved, as a result of the war, that they would turn against the authorities, that the Russian elites would try to topple the leadership, that there would be mutinies. And we came close to a mutiny a year ago.
The Prigozhin incident.
We're talking June 23. All these things did happen. But essentially, Russia has been able to withstand all those pressures, although at a price, I would say at a high price. And basically, the root cause of many of those shortcomings, let's put it that way, very charitably, was the notion that was widespread after, let's say, the early 2000s, that there'll be no large-scale wars in Europe, that Russia should not be getting ready for a major war on the European theater. And, you know, that turned out to be false. Russia did fight successfully in Syria. Russia did take over Crimea without a shot being fired. Excellent operations. The peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan in January 22. But and those were stunning achievements.
Okay, well, just as the war of attrition grinds on to what many military analysts say is certain Russian eventual victory, depending on whether there's a nuclear war beforehand, and there are NATO troops, aside from the British ones, actually stationed in Ukraine. If Trump wins, as the polls show he will, what will it mean? I know that Putin on the record said he preferred Biden because he's more predictable. Is that more worrying for world peace or given what Viktor Orban said this week and that money would stop flowing to Zelensky in Kiev, would it actually make for peace much quicker?
Well, we don't know what happens if Trump wins, whether that victory will be accepted by what some people call the deep state in the United States, whether that victory would turn U.S. foreign policy into something totally unpredictable.
Well, they could kill him.
Anything may happen. You don't rule out anything in this, at this point. So the United States may indeed be much more unpredictable if that happens. So Putin has a point, preferring the devil he knows to the situation under a Trump presidency. The current escalation policies pursued by the United States and sometimes with the initiative coming from America's European allies, those attempts at escalation, including the possibility of sending regular forces of NATO countries to Ukraine, actually are pushing us close and closer to the brink. And I'm really stunned by what I think is totally unthinkable. Particularly the countries of Europe are pushing the situation toward something that can, not theoretically, but actually obliterate their own countries. And I have only an imperfect explanation to that phenomenon.
Dr. Dmitry Trenin, thank you. And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those surviving all NATO-backed wars, despite Russian and Chinese votes at the UN for ceasefires. On Monday, we'll be talking Gaza amidst the genocide with former Israeli officer and negotiator, now president of the US Middle East Project, Daniel Levy. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.